Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Good afternoon, and welcome to this talk with Melissa De La Cruz. I am Jessica Lee. I'm a teacher librarian at Willard Middle School here in Berkeley, right on Telegraph Avenue. And I am thrilled to be spending the next hour and 15 minutes with all of you and author Melissa De La Cruz. So let's give her a big welcome.
Yay. Thanks, guys.
So do you want to just jump right into talking about your latest book, Love and War, which is a follow-up to the ever-so-popular Alex and Eliza?
Sure. I'm here for the sequel to Alex and Eliza called Love and War. So I'll talk a little bit about how I came to write Alex and Eliza and then what's kind of in store in Love and War. I took my family to go see Hamilton 2 years ago. And after half an hour of sobbing, I was kind of done. You know, I thought, okay, that was great, overwhelming, amazing experience. But my daughter, who was 9 years old at the time, just would not stop asking me about Eliza. She was obsessed with Elizabeth Schuyler. She would draw pictures of her. She would just ask me all these questions about what was real, what wasn't real, what was true, did they really meet like that, you know, what was her story. And as I did research to answer her questions, because I was really excited that she was excited about history and not about slime, because there's a lot of slime in our house. So, you know, I really wanted to encourage this. And so I did research on them and on Elizabeth Schuyler in particular. And when I was doing research, I got kind of caught up in the story. And I thought, oh my God, this is such a great American fairy tale. You know, here's Elizabeth Schuyler, who's the daughter of one of the richest, most prestigious families in New York. And why is she allowed to marry somebody like Alexander Hamilton, who came from nowhere, had no name, no money of his own. And, you know, back then, you know, the five richest families of New York just basically intermarried, just like European aristocracy. And Elizabeth's mother was Catherine Van Rensselaer, who was from the richest family in New York. The Van Rensselaer clan practically owned the whole state. So I thought, you know, what happens when somebody like that marries somebody like him? You know, what is the story behind that? Why would they allow her to marry him? And I thought it was such a great, you know, great story with a dashing young hero and, you know, this American princess. And I just got caught up in it. And I also wanted to impress my kid. So, you know, hey, you're interested in Eliza? Here you go. I wrote a whole book for you. So that was one of the reasons. And the other reason that I ended up writing Alex and Eliza was something, you know, it was interesting because we all know it wasn't a perfect marriage. He was not a perfect husband. You know, he was famously unfaithful and even wrote about it. And, you know, and somebody asked me, you know, why would you write about their love story? Why would you even celebrate something like that? And I thought, you know, I thought about it and I thought, well, the answer is she loved him and she forgave him. And to me, it was her great love for him that kind of allowed me to maybe forgive him too and want to celebrate, you know, their meeting, their union. And she died with a locket that had parts of a poem that he wrote for her during their courtship, you know, and it was just so romantic. Their story was so romantic, and, you know, the fact that after he died, she spent the rest of her life, you know, ensuring that we knew about him. You know, she went through all his papers with their third son, you know, made sure there was a biography of him, made sure we didn't forget him, and I just thought, like, a love like that should be celebrated.
Do you want to talk a little bit about your research process?
Sure. So then I pitched the book to my editor, and she was really excited, but she said, okay, that's great, but we need it in 3 months. I said, oh my God, okay. So I usually hire research assistants with my Blue Bloods books. They're set in far-flung places and in cultures that I want to make sure that I get right. And so I've always hired research assistants, and since this book was historical fiction, I wanted to make sure I got the history right and when I fixed or moved things around that I wasn't doing something that was so egregious that, you know, people would be like, oh my God, that you can't do that. So I actually hired two history professors to help me with the research. And they put together this document and I could pick out all the details that I wanted. I also read a lot of biographies of Elizabeth Schuyler, which were a little harder to find, but I found a few. They were kind of like small press books, and I really wanted to know, you know, what their daily life was like, because I wanted to focus on the domestic sphere, you know, what the balls were like. Usually they had two orchestras, which I thought was fascinating, you know, what a dance was like, what a dinner versus a supper, you know, what their clothes were like. And I would also do, I wanted to add some conflict to the story, because their love story is actually pretty fast and sweet. You know, they met 2 years before they re-met again. And when they met again, that's when they fell in love. And 6 months later, they were married. And I wanted to add a little drama and a little conflict. So I thought, what if there's another man who wants Eliza's hand? And I discovered that she actually had a crush on this British general, British major, Major John Andre, who was very handsome and dashing, very tall and blonde, apparently. And I thought, okay, so I asked my friend, the history professor, I said, what if the Schuylers want her to marry Major John Andre, and that's the conflict of the story? And he said, no, 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 the Schuylers would never want her to marry a redcoat. Are you insane? It's the revolution. Right. I said, oh, right.
The enemy. Yes.
So I'm so glad that I had, you know, an expert help me with that. And he said, you know, why don't we find somebody, you know, from one of these prominent families and kind of write him in. And Alexander Hamilton, you know, I actually called it Alex and Eliza because I wanted people to know that this was a character of my creation, because there's no way he was ever called Alex. That's, you know, that's totally my name for him. I kind of lost my train of thought there. I was talking about...
You were talking about research is where you started.
Yeah, and where I started, and Major John Andre and the Schuylers.
Creating conflict in the story?
Yes. Okay, I think I covered that.
Okay. So did you do most of the sort of fact-gathering beforehand, or did you find, like, while you were writing that suddenly there'd be some piece of information you needed and then need to delve in further?
No, I kind of knew the plot that I wanted to do, so I just kind of chose details from it, and I wanted to make sure that the timeline kind of adhered to the timeline of when they met. You know, they famously met at a ball, but we don't know, you know, what happened there, whether they even spoke to each other, so that was kind of fictionalized and embellished. Oh, and the suitor that I found was Henry Livingston, and the Livingston family actually were sponsors of Alexander Hamilton. He lived with them for a little time, and he probably flirted with Kitty Livingston, the sister, so... He was a famous flirt.
Do you include, or were there items about his life that you felt like you had to leave out of the books, considering the audience?
Not really. I mean, I think I had a little bit more, you know, fun with the flirtatious side of him in an earlier draft, and then I kind of toned that down a little.
So in Love and War, what can we expect to find there?
So the first book ends with their wedding, and then the second book starts out for them as newlyweds, and they lived all over the place, but most of the time they lived with her family in the pastures because he was still at war. And the book covers the Battle of Yorktown, but also covers a story, a very famous story of the Schuylers and the Schuyler girls, in particular, of when there was a British raid on the house, and the girls were actually the ones who defended it, and they were able to repel the British and, you know, save themselves and save their house. And there's a famous story of one of the girls actually threw an axe at one of the soldiers, and so I thought that was really cool. I think Peggy was supposed to have done that, but I think in my book it's Eliza, because we don't know who did it. We don't know if it's true. It's one of those kind of myths and legends that pop up about them, so there's never been a historian who said this definitely happened, but it's a story that's been passed down.
Of the three sisters, who do you feel you are the most similar to in your books as opposed to historically?
I don't know if I feel similar to any of them, but I always felt very intrigued by Eliza. And I think even 5 years ago, I would have been more interested in Angelica, you know, who was the sophisticated European, you know, this brilliant, sharp wit, you know, very fashionable. And I kind of like characters like that. But for some reason, I didn't really, you know, I wasn't drawn to her, you know, and she married for money. You know, she married a very, very rich man to make sure that she had this lifestyle that she was, born into. And I just really wanted to write about somebody who was good. And, you know, everything that we know about Eliza is from his letters and the way he describes her as this practical, sensible, reasonable, you know, very sweet and loving person who was a very decent human being and very kind. And I thought, I want to write about somebody like that. I think I was really tired of villains and, you know, anti-heroes and flawed people. I just wanted to write about a decent, you know, and very American girl. Mm-hmm.
What about getting to flesh out Peggy a little more? I mean, what we know about her from the musical is what, Aunt Peggy?
It was fun to flesh her out, definitely. You know, she married her cousin, who was Stephen Van Rensselaer, you know, who became a very, very wealthy man. And she died young, so we don't know a lot about her. But it was fun to kind of fictionalize them a little, because Stephen was much younger than her, so he's kind of this very awkward young man in the book.
Nice. And do Peggy and Angelica come back in Love and War, or are they off stage most of the time?
No, they're in Love and War. Nice. And one of the things in Love and War that I thought was really interesting that I discovered about Alexander Hamilton was after the war, when he became a lawyer, he was famous for defending loyalists. And loyalists were people who sided with the British. They were called loyalists, and the Americans, the rebels, were called the patriots. But they were still, you know, after the war, they still lived there. And people were trying to take their property, trying to take away their titles, their position. And Alexander Hamilton argued that that was unfair, that if we wanted to make a country out of everybody, you know, winners and losers, we had to have a United States of America, and he defended them. He had about 40 cases of defending loyalists, and he was known as somebody who was very fair-minded and just. You know, he basically defended the enemy from people taking advantage of them. So I thought that was great.
He was also incredibly young, wasn't he? I mean, how young was he when he started his legal career?
They were all kind of young, you know.
Lives were shorter then. So you talked about how you came to Alex and Eliza, but you've written many books before then. How many books have you had published total?
I think Love and War is my 46th novel. Yeah.
Thank you. And it wasn't your first career. Like most writers, you had a bit of a path to become a writer. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? What brought you to writing?
Yeah, sure. I wanted to be a writer since I was 8 years old. And that was the first time I remember, you know, really wanting to do something when I grew up. And I was 11 when I read an article about Sweet Valley High. I don't know, yeah, there's some nods. It was a YA series, you know, in the 80s. And an article in the newspaper was really interesting because it talked about how the series was created by 30-year-old Francine Pascal, but the books themselves were written by a group of 22-year-old women. And I thought, wow, that's so fascinating. I'm 11, they're 22. In 11 years, maybe I could be doing what they're doing. Because until then, I thought all authors were either 90 years old or dead. You know, I mean, I didn't know any authors. So, But, you know, there's no path to becoming a writer. There's no real, you know, path where it's like, okay, you do this, and then you get your book published. So I didn't really know how to go about that. But I thought, well, I could, you know, follow directions. There were a lot of how-to books in the bookstore. And I bought one that was called The Writer's Market. And The Writer's Market listed all the agents and publishers in the industry. And they also had guidelines on how to get an agent. And that's as much as I understood. Like, you had to get an agent to represent your book to a publisher. So I thought, okay, I can follow directions. And it said I should send a cover letter and the first five chapters of my novel. And that's what I did. I sent it out to about 25 agents, and I heard back from six agents who wanted to read the entire book. And I said, oh my God, that's awesome. So now I have to write the entire novel. So I wrote the novel, and I sent it to the six agents who were interested in me. The others were not. You get a little postcard, you know, it says, not for us, it's just a stamp, not for us. But there were six that wanted me, so I sent it to the six. And of the six agents, three of them wanted to represent me. So I picked one that seemed the most experienced, and he sent it to a bunch of editors in New York. And one of them was an editor named Jeff Klosky, who was a young editor back then at Simon & Schuster, but he had just discovered David Sedaris, Dave Eggers. You know, he was seen as an editor with taste, who could pick talent, and I was really excited to meet him. And now he's the head of Riverhead, and he publishes Khalid Hosseini, Meg Wolitzer, lots of Pulitzer Prize winners. And I was excited because he wanted to meet me. And we met for lunch, and the first thing he said was, I'm not buying your novel. And I was like, is this a date? You know, I was really annoyed. But we're friends, so we joke about that. But he told me that he liked to encourage young writers, and he thought he saw something in me, and he said, you know, this is not a novel. It's, you know, a bunch of chapters, but there's no overarching theme. Nothing really happens. You know, he kind of said you need to learn how to write a novel before you can sell one. And then he also said that I should write for magazines and newspapers because nobody would buy a novel from somebody who'd never even written an article. And I said, wow, okay. And, you know, I didn't really want to become a journalist, but I thought, okay, if it's a stepping stone to my dream, I'll do that. So I did that, and the years went by, and I still had a day job. And I wrote a second novel, and it didn't sell. And then I wrote a third novel, and by then I was 27 years old, and I wanted to be a writer since I was 8. And it felt like, oh my God, it's never going to happen. You know, I've been trying for so long. I would get really bitter going to the bookstore and seeing all the books on the shelves and knowing that mine wasn't one of them. And I thought, okay, I'm going to write this book, and if it doesn't sell, then maybe the universe is telling me I shouldn't do that. I should just give up. And I had a third agent by then, and she said, you know, I'm going to send it out, and if we get an offer, I'll call you, no matter what time it is, because she knew I had a day job. And I said, okay. And I was at a meeting with my clients. I was actually a computer programmer back then, and it was, you know, something to keep me financially independent in New York. And my phone rang. And I said, oh my God, this is it. And I was in a client meeting, but I just got up. You know, I said, sorry, I gotta go. And I took my phone to the lobby, and sure enough, she said, we got an offer from Simon & Schuster. They want to buy your book. And it was the third happiest day of my life after my wedding and the birth of my child. But my husband and child are not here right now, so I can be completely honest. It was the happiest day of my life. It was amazing. I was so happy when she told me that they were going to buy it.
And so. And what was that first book?
It was called Cats Meow, and it was kind of a satire of New York.
For teens or for adults?
It was an adult book.
Okay. So you started in the adult world, and then you moved up to YA, as we like to see.
Yeah. you know, it's funny, because you get your foot in the door, and nobody tells you that the second novel is even harder than the first, you know, because you spent all these years trying to write one novel, and then, oh my God, what am I going to do for the second act? And I was actually a journalist by then. I was writing for Harper's Bazaar, Marie Claire, Cosmopolitan, and I actually had a nonfiction book that my friend and I had sold, and we were on tour for that. When my editor, so back off a little. So after, you know, the first book was published, it was all great. A couple of months later, my editor said, well, what do you want to do for a second book? And I said, I don't know. And she said, well, why don't you write a murder mystery? You know, we publish those a lot. You could write one every year. It would be, you know, a great, you know, career for you. I said, okay, I'll try it. I wrote a proposal for a murder mystery, and I sent it to Doris. And then a week later, she called me, and she said, yeah, you can't write murder mysteries. I said, fine, okay. So, you know, I worked on my nonfiction book, and I was on tour, and Doris called again, and she said, okay, I have a new idea for you. We're publishing in this genre called YA. It's for teenagers. Have you heard of Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants or Gossip Girl? And I said, yes. I think I even read Gossip Girl, so I was excited about that. And she said, well, do you think you want to try your hand at it? And I said, sure. You know, so I got on the plane, and I was writing my proposal for my first YA book. And even as I was writing it, I thought, oh, this is what I'm supposed to do. I really felt like it was a match with the genre. I had so much fun. And it was just, you know, kind of a natural place for my writing. And I wrote about 16 YA books before I wrote another adult book. So,
so you've written about vampires, nannies, witches, a dystopian Las Vegas that's frozen, historical fiction. You've pretty much covered everything except murder mysteries, or have you had a
I guess so.
So how hard is it for your readers when you're jumping from genre to genre? Do you find that's hard for your readers, or do you find that you just have different readers for different books?
Yeah, you know, I think the reason I'm able to jump around genre-wise is because I write in the YA category, so they're used to writers writing lots of different kinds of books. Yeah, I mean, there's some of my readers have followed me since, Blue Bloods. I have a lot of Blue Bloods readers. And, you know, now they buy the Descendants books for their kids, and that makes me feel really old, but, but it's kind of cool. I think, you know, there's definitely pockets of readers that are, you know, I'm a Blue Bloods reader, I'm a Descendants reader, but there's definitely a little crossover as well.
Mm-hmm. And so you don't get any feedback like, oh my God, where are the vampires? Why are you writing this with no vampires?
No, I think they if they want me to write more vampire books, they just say, we would just like more Blue Bloods books.
Yes. But,
yeah.
Are there certain books from your past that have really good legs that sort of keep selling even though you've moved on?
Yeah, the Blue Blood series does pretty well. Okay. Yeah.
Nice. Do you want to talk a little bit about Isle of the Lost and what that was like creating a book that was also a TV series, mm-hmm. and how that works?
Yeah, sure. So, like I said, Blue Bloods was my big vampire series, and it was actually published by Disney. So I'd been with Disney for about 14 years and had published many books with them. And then they moved part of their editorial staff to L.A. And the head of Disney Publishing said, let's go to lunch. And we were friends, so I thought, okay, let's go to lunch. Maybe we'll go shopping, you know, girl talk. And I just realized, you know, since she never asked me to lunch again, oh, there's always an agenda. And we caught up, and at the end of the lunch, she said, you know, we have this new project that's kind of multi-platform that we've been kicking around, and I think we'd like to have an original book series be part of it. Would you be interested in being the author for that? And I said, okay, well, what is it? And she said, it's about the children of Disney's greatest villains. And I said, oh my God, that's amazing. You know, I would love to do that. And I had literally been on the phone with my agent that morning, and I told him my new idea was to do a big fairy tale series. Mm-hmm. And I even told him, and I want a big corporate partner. So it was so funny that it never even occurred to me to pitch it to Disney. But I told her that. I said, oh my God, I want to do fairy tales. That's my next thing. And now here you are handing me, you know, the whole Disney fairy tale universe. Mm-hmm. So I was really excited. I'm a Disney kid, and my daughter was about, you know, either 6 or 7 when I started Descendants. And we had just watched all the original movies, so it was actually fresh in my mind. Sleeping Beauty, Beauty and the Beast, all of those. And not only that, but she was a huge fan of the Disney Channel, so I was really familiar with Liv and Maddie and Ant Farm and all those shows. So I really felt like I could be kind of the bridge between the iconic animation movies and, you know, kind of the new Disney Channel live action movie. And it was a huge project. It was a book series, a TV movie, toys, animation, music, So we would have meetings with 200 people in a room talking about exactly how purple Mal's hair should be. So it was just kind of crazy. It was crazy to be part of this big kind of franchise. And working with Disney was really interesting because I had to work with somebody who was the Disney lore expert, you know, and a Disney kind of person who made sure that we didn't, you know, I didn't step on anything or I didn't mess up something that was very important to Disney. And it would never be, the notes would come back and it would never be anything I was worried about. It would never be about the storyline. It never be about, you know, plot arcs or anything like that, because that was what I was always worried about, that I wouldn't be able to tell the story I wanted to tell. No, they were always fine with that. It would always be something so odd and something I could never predict. And I remember in the second book, I wrote about Tinkerbell, and the note came back and it said, "Tinkerbell does not have any descendants." And I was like, oh, okay. You could not even intimate that Tinkerbell got busy with anybody. You know? Tinkerbell is the head of the Disney parade. She's an iconic character on all the Disney logos. You do not mess with Tinkerbell. So,
she is pure.
Yeah. I thought that was so funny. I was like, I would never know that. Okay, fine. So it was like stuff like that that was really interesting.
Okay. So they did most of the world building, and then you inserted the story into it, or did you get to do some of the world building as well?
No, we did that all together.
It was collaborative?
Yeah. Neat. Yeah.
Was there anything you really wanted other than, you know, Tinkerbell? Was there anything you really wanted that...
What did I want? I think at some point there was a little bit of, very high up. And I say very high up, very high, basically the head of Disney, said that he wanted us to focus on the new characters and to not really play around with the older iconic characters. Uh-huh. So that's what we did in the movies and in the books. And it was fine. You know, I mean, I kind of liked having the older iconic characters to play with, but I was also fine with playing with the... And the main story was always the descendants, you know, the villain kids. So,
and were you writing for the series, the movies as well, or were you just writing the books themselves?
It was a multi-platform project where we had to work together. So there were screenwriters who were writing the movies, but I wrote the books. Okay. And the books are different from the movies, which I think even in tone, because I have a very fairy tale tone, and they have, you know, a very kind of cheerful Disney Channel tone. So, and the Disney Channel was actually fine with that. They liked that the books had a richer, more layered, more fairy tale feeling. You know, it's not something that they could do on the TV movie, but they appreciated it and they loved the book. And in my book, you know, there's talking animals in the Disney original movies. So I had talking animals, and they were a little bit worried that there were no talking animals in the TV movie, but, you know, they would kind of allow it. I mean, it was a pretty easy at the end.
Okay. Yeah. So it didn't have to be completely lockstep the whole way.
Yeah, I think at one point, after we developed these characters, the idea was that I could have, you know, a completely... original take on them and a whole new story. But then as we went forward with the development, it actually made more sense if the movies and the books kind of worked in the same universe and were part of the same timeline. Mm-hmm. And we did try to put the animation as part of our timeline too, but then it felt too difficult because the animation... I remember one of the things that was something that we wanted to make sure matched with the books and the movies. In the movies, they couldn't have a lot of magic because that meant special effects, which meant a bigger budget. So they were really careful about what magic could be in the script. But I had the book and, you know, I could write whatever I wanted, but they didn't want it to be so different in that way. But then with the animation, when, you know, they had the no magic restriction, they really felt like, well, what can we do then? So they were allowed to have little spells.
So, getting back to your more recent writing with Alex and Eliza, and then of course Love and War, have you had any contact with Lin-Manuel Miranda and that side of the world?
You know, we have a friend in common, and Alex was actually trying to get the two of us to do a book event together. And he came pretty close, but I think Lin's schedule was too difficult. Okay. So,
do you know if he's read your book?
I don't think he has. I know he's seen the Subway ads, because we had a lot of Subway ads. And Javier, who played Hamilton after him, took a picture of himself with the ad. Nice. And said, oh, our story is out, the secret's out, or something. It was really cute.
Cute. And how different do you find that people are coming to this hoping to see the same story that's in the musical, or are they, because you tell a very different story?
I do, and you know, I only felt comfortable writing this book because I had my own take on the history and my own take on the story, and I was not interested in writing Hamilton. I mean, mm-hmm. Obviously it was already written. So in my book, you know, Angelica and Alex, you know, are not interested in each other because I read the same source material, and I was like, oh, you just don't know. When you have a sister, I was like, that would never happen. You know, they loved each other, and there was no way that Angelica would ever betray her in that way. And they were close until they died. And I think one of the things that bonded them was they both loved Alex, and the fact that Angelica thought he was so great. You know how that is? Like when somebody close to you thinks that your spouse is so awesome, it kind of bonds you too. Mm-hmm. So. That would not have been something. And it's interesting because some people say, oh, you're quoting from the lyrics. And like, no, the lyrics quote from the source material. Like, that is from his letters,
right,
you know.
Right. So you felt, how bound did you feel to the historical source material?
I wanted to write something that was recognizable, mm-hmm. but I don't feel like I have to be completely restricted. You know, there are some events there, you know, I play with dates a little. And like I said, I hired these history professors. So when, you know, I would play with things, they would say, okay, you can do that, but try not to do that, you know, or, you know, oh, that's really going to piss off some history teachers. Let's not do that, you know. So, to me, the story is the most important, and I kind of put things to make sure they fit my story, because I kind of do the same with myth, like the Norse myths are in Witches of East End, and I kind of manipulated them to fit my story. So I'm kind of used to doing that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you want to talk a little bit about your writing process? Like, what does a day look like for you as a writer?
This is the question that all writers lie when they answer, because there's no real day. You know, it's not a 9-to-5 job. You know, it's probably a 12 p.m. to 5 a.m. job. Mm-hmm. Because the only answer is, you know, I try to get some writing done every day, but not really. Most writers are really lazy. I mean, if it's not due, it's like, it's not due. And then, you know,
kids, don't listen to this.
Yeah. And then once the deadline is really near, that's when all this furious activity happens. So I kind of write, you know, it takes me, you know, probably, I write really fast. So it's also hard to answer that question because I can write a book in 2 weeks. I try not to do that, but I have. So knowing that I can do that, you know, makes me procrastinate a lot. Like, well, I can get it done in 2 weeks. You know, I don't have to do it now. But I try to get at least 100 pages done over maybe 2 months, and then spend another 3 weeks writing the rest of the book. And that's when it's like a furious, frenetic, I don't leave my house, I don't really eat, I look terrible, you know. And I just get it done. And that's the only thing that gets the book done, is doing that kind of work. But I am a procrastinator and a crammer, so that's how I get it done.
And do you do one book at a time, or do you start one, and then while you're writing one, you're editing one or something?
Yeah, I'm always in each part of the process. So I'm either in a first draft of one, in like a copy edit of the other, in proposal stage for another one. I like it. I really like my work. I really like working on a lot of books because I get bored quickly, so I want to do something new. So I always have a lot of projects that I'm working on, and I don't really have a lot of hobbies. And I only work, and then so I'm either on or off. So if I'm on, I'm just working, and then if I'm off, it's like I don't even remember what's work.
And then you get sent on tour. So this is your 12th city in how many days?
It's a 12 city tour.
Okay. Do you get any writing done in between, like in airports and hotels? Are you writing or are you just only touring?
I used to work on tour. I remember I had just given birth to my daughter and I was on tour with my nanny. And the book was due, and I did the event, and then wrote at night. And that, you know, so I do, and I did that a little bit earlier in my career, you know, trying to get all the books done in this pace. I don't do it as much anymore, so I've pushed back a little bit on that, because it is hard to travel. Some writers like it, you know, they say they like working on the airplane, you know, it's kind of quiet. And sometimes I do. Sometimes I work on the airplane. Sometimes I work in hotels. So again, there's not like, oh, I always work on tour. I never work on tour. It just depends on, you know, what's kind of due at that time.
Can you talk about your next book that's coming out?
Sure. Let me think about what's coming out. I have a bunch of books coming out next year. One I can't talk about yet because it hasn't been announced. But I do have a new Disney series called The Squad, which is about a group of kids who discover that they are gifted by the gods. But it's a multicultural pantheon of gods. So there's an Aztec goddess of beauty. There's a Celtic god of thunder. There's Lucundo, the African warrior hunter. And there's the Chinese monkey of legend, which is really fun. So it's actually like a superhero slash supernatural gods kind of mashup. And it's really fun. And it's called The Squad.
And is that YA, or would you say it's more like middle grade?
It's middle grade. It's okay. Aimed for the Descendants readers. So
okay. Younger readers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you also recently had a realistic fiction book come out.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk about that one a little bit?
Sure. So sometimes, like I said, publishing, you know, has ideas for you or they have projects that they want you to do. And one of the things that happened was we got a call from Harlequin and 17 Magazine, and they were starting an imprint that 17 Magazine wanted to create books that were based on real life that teens face. And they wanted to start with a book about immigration, specifically a teen who was going through being an illegal immigrant. And they asked me if I would be interested in writing this novel for them. And, you know, it was a little hard. I had to think about it because I really felt like, oh, do I have to go back there? Do I have to feel those feelings again? Because my family immigrated here when I was 13. And while we were never undocumented, my dad was a businessman. And he applied to switch over from the business visa to a green card. But what happened was the lawyer that he'd hired actually just took the money and didn't file the application. So there were all these years wasted when we thought we were waiting for a green card when really there was nothing going on. And then when my dad found out and he applied and finally did get his green card, my sister and I were over the age of 21 because we'd lost all those years. And there was no law for the children of legal immigrants, you know, for adult children of legal immigrants back then. Now they've changed the law, and adult children of legal immigrants get their green card when their parents do. But back then in the 80s, there was nothing. And our new lawyer told us that we could stay in the country because we actually had work permits, and it was fine, but we probably couldn't travel until, you know, we got our green card. So it was just this weird feeling of being, you know, while not being, you know, illegal and undocumented, you know, having this kind of gray, ambiguous area where, you know, I felt American, you know, in myself, my identity, my spirit, but, you know, my papers didn't prove that, you know, so I just didn't want to go back to feeling that vulnerable again. So it took me a while to, you know, say yes to this project, and I also wanted to do it, you know, do it right. So then I felt like, you know, who else can write this? You know, who else knows what that feels like? So I wanted to write it.
So does that feel like the most autobiographical book you've written?
No. I actually did write about my family and how we immigrated to the U.S. It was a book called Fresh Off the Boat that came out in 2005. Although I tell everybody it's fictional, it is about my family, as my brother and sister keep reminding me. Mm-hmm. the family in Something in Between, while the feelings, you know, come from my experience, the story is not autobiographical.
So since you've written such a variety of books, do you feel like there's anything that ties them together? Anything that you would say is like something you can expect to find in a Melissa De La Cruz book?
I always think that the thing that ties my books together is my sense of humor. You know, it's like I like to have kind of a lightness. And then I also have, you know, certain things that I like. I like when the hero is so handsome. So I think I remember I was writing a phrase and I said, oh, I always write that. Where it's like, she sees him again. Oh, he's even more handsome on the second time. So yeah, there's some quirks like that.
And I see romance in all of your books. Is mm-hmm. that accurate? Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a driving force throughout.
Yeah, you know, which is so funny because my first book, like I said, was a satire and kind of this tongue-in-cheek book about New York. And I remember telling my husband, I did not want to write a romance. No romance. and in the end, the story didn't work without like even just a little hint of romance. You know, I remember my editor telling me the characters have to be somewhere different at the end than from the beginning. They have to change. They have to grow. It's called a novel. And I said, fine. Because I really, you when you're young, you kind of want to break all the rules without even knowing them. And then, you know, like I said, when I started writing my first YA book, I just thought, oh, I can write about this. Oh, I'm really good at this. Oh, I love writing romance. And he's really handsome the second time you see him again.
And do you feel, I don't know, comfortable writing about the physical nature of romance, or do you keep it mostly chaste?
Oh, no. You got people like my books because we are not chaste. So. Which is funny because my daughter, you know, sadly is the daughter of a novelist, and her friends all bought one of my books, and they were like, Maddie, did you read page 210? And she was like, what happens in page 210, Mama? And I was like, oh, dear. You know, so, yeah. And it's funny. I don't think, you know, even writing, Disney was my publisher, but I never really, the only time they ever asked me to kind of tone things down was when I was writing my vampire series. And I was inspired to write about these kids. They were kind of based on these very, you know, mature teenagers that I kind of observed. I was a party reporter for Harper's Bazaar, and I would go to these parties and see, 17-year-old Paris Hilton, 15-year-old Nikki Hilton with their, you know, 30, 35-year-old boyfriends. And it just struck me how old they were. You know, I overheard them, you know, talking to each other, and I just thought, oh, my God, these are like the oldest teenagers in the world. So I wanted to write about, how these Manhattan kids grow up so fast. And so I wrote one of the girls in my book had, you know, a 35-year-old boyfriend, and I remember my editor said, can we just tone him down? Can he be 24? You know? So
I bet you guys have a bunch of questions that you're dying to ask. So let me see. Somebody is supposed to have a microphone for the audience. Yay! And where do you want them to line up? Oh, just raise your hand and the microphone will come to you.
Oh, right there. Can you talk about what it was like transitioning from having, I think you said, computer science job into being a full-time writer?
Sure. Yeah, I kind of skipped over that. I was an English major, and my friends were all going to be lawyers. And they said, let's all take the LSAT together, and then let's apply to law school together, and then wouldn't it be fun to all have a law firm together when we get out? And I thought, oh, okay, interesting. You know, I mean, I guess I could write and research two things that I like to do. And my mom sent a check for the study class, and it was a lot of money. It was about $1,500, and it was a lot of money to waste. You know, because I thought, okay, if I take my parents' money and take this class, take the LSAT, you know, apply for law school, get into law school, like I couldn't, you know, just take that check and then like say no later. I knew taking that check meant it was like this whole path that I had to go down on. And so I never actually cashed the check because I just didn't want to go down that path, although I still have it and I should probably cash it and scare my mom. So what happened was I graduated with an English degree, and I actually got recruited to work for a firm, and my boss told me that he liked to hire, and he hired about four of us, and we were all English majors. He said, I like to hire English majors and teach them computer programming. I find it's easier than hiring computer programmers and teaching them how to talk to people. So I thought, wow. So that was interesting. So, you know, and we all kind of developed an aptitude for it. I was actually pretty good at it. It was always my day job. You know, I never wanted to get promoted or never tried that hard, you know, but sadly, you know, I was kind of good at logic, so I would find all these, you know, big hole, you know, I was so good at it now, but I was pretty good at it, but I didn't want that to be, you know, what I did. You know, it was always just a stepping stone, and I was always writing on the side, you know. I worked for a lot of big banks, and there was so much downtime. I mean, it's amazing when I think about it. Like, we were all in one room, and everybody had solitaire on their screen. Like, they're just we were hired to maintain a database, you know, and so we would only really work if something was wrong or buggy, and half the time we were just kind of sitting around. So they played solitaire, and I wrote my novels. So that was kind of fun.
Are they hiring?
Yeah, I know. It was a great job. It was a different time. Right. And it was a time before, I think, a lot of people knew how to do computers. Mm-hmm. You know, it was kind of seen, like, we worked with a big mainframe, so we actually had to learn C and COBOL, some really old languages. And then as, you know, it modernized and as more people... I just remember when we had the people who could build the website, you know, like, I was like, wow. So it got, I think they kind of phased out a lot of those jobs.
Yeah. I'm curious what your revision process looks like.
Oh, my revision process. I actually revise during the first draft stage. So I don't do what some writers do, which is just write, you know, kind of this messy, ugly draft. Like, sometimes they call it the zero draft. My first drafts look more like third drafts, because as I write, I go back and fix the pages that I wrote before, or I move stuff around, because I'm an outliner, so I have a big outline, and I write about 100 pages, and then I kind of decide whether my outline is good, and I can keep going with that outline, or I should revise the outline, and then revise some of the chapters. So it's kind of like always evolving, and I think I learned how to do that because I needed to be fast. We published one Blue Bloods novel every year, and they were actually quite big, big books with a lot of like plot twists. So I had to know how to do that quickly. And then there was that whole, you know, trying to meet those deadlines too. So that's how I kind of learned how to write. But With something in between, we actually did like a more traditional revise where I wrote the entire book and I actually revised it twice, like a huge revise where I had to rewrite a lot of chapters, have to move things around, and it was a lot more difficult to get that story right from the beginning. Yeah. Oh, right there?
For a story like Blue Blood, for the series, did you always know how your series was going to end, or did you weave in possible plot points you could pick on later on in earlier books?
No, I always knew how it was going to end. It was a fun project because I wrote an entire kind of backstory, and then I wrote a larger outline for the books. Like I knew what each book would be, and then each book I would outline that book, but I knew where it stood in the larger story. So that was a really fun project for me because I really wanted to do a big kind of dramatic paranormal series, and I was a big fan of Stephen King's The Dark Tower, which I had just finished, and it was really disappointing because it was clear that he didn't know how to end it because it ends like so disappointingly. And I remember I wanted to write Blue Bloods and say, I know how it's going to end, and this is how it's going to end. I'm going to know it from the beginning because I'm going to write a book series that has an ending. So while I knew all the kind of the big plot points and the big twists and what happened before, it was fun to kind of play within the books and discover new things. And like, so there were some surprises for me as well, but kind of the main points of the series I knew.
Can I ask a two-part question?
A
two-part question?
Sure.
So the first part is, which kind of connects to what you were just saying, who are your authorly inspirations, the people that you're like, oh, I really want to write like that person? And also when someone comes to you and is like, I really love your books, but I've read all of them. I don't know how that person did it, but what do you recommend that's similar to you, that you feel are sort of in the same part of the forest?
Sure. I was a big Stephen King fan. For my teen years, I read all of his books, you know, probably from the time I was a freshman to the time I was a senior. And I looked up all the old books from the 70s from the library, and I was pretty much like a very devoted fan. And then I kind of wasn't, you know, and I still love his books, but I don't read them anymore, except for the Dark Tower series. So every time he has a new Dark Tower book, I'm there. But I found them a little too, you know, it's funny, I think they're too scary for me now. Whereas when I was younger, you know, I was able to read them and still feel a little distance. I think when you get older, you know, the horrors are too much. But I was a big Stephen King fan. I was a big Anne Rice fan. I loved The Vampire Chronicles, and then I was a big sci-fi fantasy reader. I loved the Dune, the sixth series, original Dune series, and Tolkien. I loved Lord of the Rings. I read that when I was 13, and I would reread it, you know, every 2 years I would reread it. So I was a big kind of fantasy and sci-fi reader in my teen years, and then I loved Harry Potter. I loved Harry Potter. I was older when I read it, but I loved it, and I thought Harry Potter really kind of rejuvenated my love for reading, and kind of rejuvenated kind of everybody. Like, oh my God, books are so fun, and it yeah, and we'd forgotten, you know, and it was so fun. And you know, she kind of created this whole market that we're in now. So, so that was amazing. And books that are kind of similar to mine. It's interesting. Like it's different at each, you know, kind of iteration of my career. Kind of earlier, the Au Pairs and the Ashley's books are a lot like Gossip Girl and The Click. Blue Bloods. It's funny because I finished the first book and I pitched it to my publisher because I said, oh my God, nobody's writing about vampires. Let's do a vampire book. And it was just like, wow. And then I turned it in, and I walked to the bookstore, and I saw Twilight. And I said, oh no. And I said, oh no, it's, you know, her book is out a year before mine, because it takes a year after you turn it in for the book to come out. I said, oh no, then nobody's going to read mine, because hers came out a year before. And it turned out that was totally not true. It was, you know, Twilight got everybody interested in vampires, so kind of created this vampire wave. But our books are very different, you know. So, you know, while they're both about teenage vampires, it's just a very, very different. You know, hers is set in, you know, kind of a small town, suburban life, rural. Mine is set in Manhattan. You know, I had just moved to LA and I was missing New York so much. And I put, you know, kind of like all my love for New York, all my memories, the clubs they went to were the clubs my friends and I went to. You know, I just put the everything, you know, as a journalist, as, you know, somebody who covered kind of that glitzy scene, I put that all in the books. I think who else was like my books? Like Alison Noel had a Immortal series. I think people who read my books liked hers too. I think with Descendants, you know, it's kind of hard. Although I think it's in the fairy tale genre, so I think we had their School for Good and Evil that Soma and Cennini writes. I think that would be a good comparison. Yeah.
Adam Gidwitz.
Oh yeah, Adam Gidwitz, a good friend of mine. Yep, the grim fairy tales.
A tale dark and grim.
Yes.
You have had incredible projects and interesting partnerships, and I was wondering, is there any of you went, oh, I wish I had done that one? Are there any that you didn't take that you thought?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question. Not really, you know. There have been some projects that I turned down, but I don't regret it, you know. And books aren't like parts, you know. It's not like I turned down a starring role, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they're still projects that I would have to put in my imagination and my time into. And there were some things that... There were two projects that it turned out, you know, I was like, well, I don't know if I want to put all that time into that. You know, I liked it, you know, and I said yes at first, and I thought about it more, and I said, you know what, I don't have time. You know, I like the idea, but I don't love it, you know. And usually it's just with collaborating with people, and you just don't have time to. And one of the things that I turned down when I was doing Blue Bloods is Nickelodeon came and said, oh, we want to do a TV show. Will you pitch us a TV show with one of our, you know, kind of seasoned producers? And I said, sure. And so we worked on this TV show and all that. It was a teen Lost, I remember. And it was kind of fun. And then they said, okay, if it goes through, which it will, you know, you're going to have to go to Vancouver and work on the set, da, da, da. And I said, yeah, I don't want to do that. And my agent's always like, why'd you turn that down? I was like, I don't know. And I think I thought at that time, oh, these things just come all the time. Somebody's always going to be knocking on your door. And it's like, no. But, you know, I don't regret that either, you know. You know, I just felt like that would be too hard with my writing schedule, with my family schedule, that, you know, I didn't really want to be a producer of a TV show like that and working on something, you know, like almost full time. Mm-hmm. And I always just consult on the TV shows. I don't work on it. I always say I want to be welcome on the set and I want to see the scripts and that's it. Mm-hmm. I don't have to be anywhere. I told my agent, I don't want a boss. And he's like, yeah, no boss for you.
A similar question. Are there any properties that you really want to work on that you haven't been offered yet?
You know, not really. I think at one point, before Disney had bought all of Star Wars, when it was just like a smaller... not a small thing, but they weren't sure, you know, what direction to go with the books. They did ask me to do a Star Wars book, and I was open to it. But then in the end, I kind of felt like, you know, unlike Descendants, you know, which I could kind of shape and, you know, and I could, you know, kind of create from the beginning. And like the Star Wars universe is so much bigger than any writer. And really, they could probably plug in, you know, anybody. Although I still kind of want to do one. I mean, you know, I always tell them, oh, I'll do one at some point. So.
Hi.
Hi.
Did you ever had like a really giant writer's block in your life when you were writing one of these books?
Not really. You know, what's funny about writer's block for me is I think writer's block is the reason I have so many books, because every time I get blocked on one, I just start a new one. And then I just go back and forth on the projects. And, you know, I write on the other one, and then I finally go back to the original one. But you can always be sure that whatever book I'm working on is the one that is not due. You know, the one that's due, oh, we're not working on that. That's too much pressure.
How did you cope with the self-doubt of, like, your first couple books and pitching them to agents and publishers and stuff like that?
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting because I think a lot of what drives me is that I was pretty confident, you know? You know, it's you know, I didn't really have a lot of self-doubt, which is kind of crazy to me, you know, when I look back at it. You know, and when I write my books, definitely there's like, you know, oh God, this is terrible. You know, oh, my job is so hard. And there's a lot of doubt when I'm working and creating it. But when I send it out, you know, I'm pretty confident in my work. And I think it was because my parents were always really encouraging of my artistic impulses. Like, they really, you know, encouraged that. And, you know, my teachers, you know, I had my sophomore English teacher was the first one to say, you're going to be a writer someday. And I just thought, you know, and it really, like, oh, my God, you know, if Mr. Oren says I'm going to be a writer, you know, maybe it'll happen. Like, there was just a lot of, like, very positive feedback. I won some poetry contests in high school. I won like a couple of essay contests. So I knew I was a good writer. When I was in college, I got into like a senior creative writing seminar that was only open to upperclassmen. And you actually had to write your way into it to get into the class. And I got in as a freshman. So I felt really, I felt a lot of validation throughout my writing kind of career, you know, even before I was a writer. So I had a lot of confidence in my ability. And then, you know, even when I didn't know anybody and I didn't know how to become an author, you know, I thought I could follow these directions, you know, and send it out. You know, and even before that, I'd actually tried to get an MFA because I thought, well, maybe I'll get an MFA in creative writing and, you know, that'll be a way to go in. And I really didn't want to because I didn't want to spend that much money. It seemed so self-indulgent to do that. But I thought, you know, I was getting kind of desperate. Okay, let's do this. And I applied to about six MFA programs, and I did not get into any one. I was like, you know, just like the one-line rejection. Mm. And I remember laughing when I got the rejections. I remember thinking, oh, they're wrong. I'll show you. Yeah. 46 books later. you know, I just, you know, it does, you know, I don't know why I didn't give up, but I didn't. You know, I really felt like, you know, but one thing that I tell a lot of kids who want to be writers is that, you know, because I did feel a little entitled. You know, I felt like I was really smart and I was talented and I was entitled to become a writer. And it really doesn't work that way, you know. And I really had to figure out how to connect with an audience, because until I sold my book, I didn't realize people actually had to like it. And a lot of people had to like it. Like, your editor had to like it. The marketing and sales people had to like it. You know, everybody in your publishing house had to like this book. And then they sent it out and the booksellers had to like it, you know, like, and all these people, and then readers had to like it. So, you know, the main thing that I've learned is you really have to connect with your readers, which was a little humbling because I thought, you know, as a straight A student, as an overachiever, if I just checked all those boxes, you know, ta-da, you would have this wonderful career. And it's really not like that. And it was a humbling experience to realize that you couldn't just be this clever overachiever and expect people to buy your books. Like, nobody's entitled to that.
So. From a fellow procrastinator / multitasker, where have you found work-life balance? Is that something you always strive for? When do you know when to stop before you burn yourself out?
Still looking for that. I think you just make certain things a priority. Like, my family is a priority. My kid is a priority. You know, I try not to miss things, that she's in, and I don't. I'm there for every game. I'm there for every show. I pick her up. She's the biggest priority. But then after that, you know, your work has to be a huge priority. And you have to make your work a priority or you'll never get it done. Like, if you say yes to so many, social invitations, or you fill up your life too much with obligations like that, it's hard sometimes. I was working on my book, on the Third Descendants book, and my friends called, and they said, "We're in a yacht in St. Bart's. Come down now." And I said, "I can't go to St. Bart's. You know, I can't go on your yacht." I was like, "God damn it, why now? You know, like, why not like in a month when I'm done?" And, you know, you turn down a lot of, opportunities like that. And I think you just kind of have to have friends who understand, you know, that you're not around. I mean, when I'm on deadline, I do not really have a life outside of work. You kind of have to, you know, pick up your life right after. Like, I turn in a book and I go to the doctor, the dentist, I see my friends. You know, it's like you check off all the real life things. But it's hard to have work-life balance every day, although I think it's good to get out of your office too. So I think, you know, sadly, I've come to realize exercise is good for you. So.
I was just wondering what kind of writing resources or plot structure resources you use.
I don't really use anything that I've, you know, I learned like a three-act structure from my first editor, you know, kind of who walked me through, she said, you know, it's got to be a novel, you know, maybe you should outline it. And I'd never really thought about that before, but, you know, she kind of, you know, taught me about all that. So I use a three-act structure. And, you know, some writers like story by, you know, they use screenwriting structures with novel writing. I've never read story. I think it's a little bit like I plan and then like it's instinct also, you know. So yeah, I'm trying to think. There's a bunch of books that I did read. I like Stephen King's On Writing. I like Anne Lamott's Bird by Bird. My sister gave me a book once after I'd published my first novel that was, what's his last name? It's like a murder writer. It was called How to Tell Lies. How to Tell Lies and Deceive People and like novel writing. And it was kind of a joke, but it was actually a pretty good book. No, Telling Lies for Fun and Profit. That was what it was called. It was a good book.
So after 46 books, is there any one that you're particularly proud of that stands out above the rest? Or on the flip side, if somebody had never read any of your books, is there one that you would say, just don't read that one?
I'm really proud of the Blue Blood series. That was something that was really close to my heart that I really wanted to do. I wanted to do a big fantasy series. The second book, called Masquerade, was the only book that came direct from an outline, where I wrote this outline and I wrote the book and it was perfect. I didn't have to change anything, so it was really easy to write it, and it's never happened again. So I'm like, wow, that was like the miracle book. So I love that book. I did these two, you know, nonfiction books with a friend of mine. One is called How to Become Famous in 2 Weeks or Less, which we wrote as journalists. We were tasked with, you know, being famous in 2 weeks. Like, we had to get on the Today Show, get on MTV, have a party thrown for us, all these kind of, like, funny, silly things. But it was before reality shows and before, you know, shows like American Idol even. So it was kind of it was an interesting exercise. But they put this photo of us on the cover, some random photo from a party, and we look horrible. So don't buy that book. I was like, oh, I hate that cover.
Okay, so books will be available for purchase and signing, these three titles, I believe, through those doors and into the courtyard. We actually have 5 minutes if there was any last questions before we excuse. So let's give a huge thanks to Melissa for her time.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.